on average, it's not doing much harm. On average, if you measure how many hours people spend on social media, and then you look at their subsequent levels of depression or anxiety, for example, there's either no relationship or it's so tiny that it's not meaningful or nothing to be worried about. A lot of people have kind of concluded that that's sort of job done, or, you know, social media isn't harmful. But I think still within that, just because on average there's not much of a relationship, there are still some young people and some adults who are reasonably being harmed by what they're doing online for all sorts of reasons.
Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. With me is Lucy Folks, an academic psychologist with expertise in adolescent mental health and social cognition. She's an honorary lecturer at University College London and a senior research fellow at the Anna Freud National Center for Children and Families. She's the author of the book, Losing Our Minds, What Mental Illness Really Is and Isn't, which explores how we talk about mental health and illness, particularly in young people. Lucy, welcome to Science for the People.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start precisely where you start your book. Even before the introduction, you have a note on terminology. And to open that chapter, you have a quote from Nathan Filler, which for me is both an entry point and an important reminder to the book. And I think it's also an important one for the conversation today. And that quote is, "There is no uncontroversial language when talking about mental illness," and that includes the phrase mental illness. So can you unpack that quote for us and talk a little bit about why you decided to open your book with it?
Well, the more I wrote of the book and the more research I did for it, and the more I read, I realized that everything I was saying really came back to language. It was about what we call these problems and how the names that we give them affect our understanding of the problem and what we do about them. So partly it's that, is that I felt language sort of runs through everything that I say. So I wanted to open with a point about that. And it was also partly, to be honest, to protect myself in a way, because I had made a commitment to talking about mental illness and calling these things illnesses and disorders. But I'm very aware that that's imperfect, that some people don't want to call them that. I sort of sympathize and understand with the viewpoint that sometimes we shouldn't call these things illnesses or disorders. So I kind of wanted to let the reader know that I knew that, you know, mental illness is in the title, in the subtitle, but I'm not pretending it's straightforward or that that's always a good word to use.
Language is definitely something of a theme in your book. It circles around this idea of imperfect language, or language that we do and don't have to be able to describe the things we're trying to describe and that we're reckoning with. And I definitely appreciate that the book is very open about this reckoning of the language of mental illness. In particular, this idea that language, a lot of the language has to carry sort of several definitions in the discussion at once, all kind of simultaneously. A great example is a word like anxiety or a word like depression, which have and continue to have colloquial meaning and now also have become medical terms used both expertly and inexpertly. And it makes this conversation so much more difficult because we don't quite have the right words.
Exactly. And different people have different understandings of those words. And it's shifting all the time. You know, so it's not like there's a fixed medical definition of anxiety and a fixed, you know, emotion definition of anxiety. And, you know, philosophers and psychologists and psychiatrists have been battling with trying to define it, these things, over, you know, decades and centuries. So, yeah, but it's a big part of the problem is that we don't have a shared understanding or agreement about what these words actually mean.
As with all words that are talking about subjective experiences, it's always so difficult to really try and nail something down with precision.
Definitely. And maybe you can't, and maybe that can never be the goal. You know, anxiety, for example, you know, maybe we need to allow some room for people to use it in a slightly flexible way. I don't know. It means different things to different people. But what one key reason why I wrote the book in the first place was that I felt we need to at least to try and have a discussion about what these words mean and how we should use them in order, in order that they're useful for everyone, right? In order that they're not overused for people who don't really need them, and in order that they don't sort of lose meaning for people who are most unwell. That was a kind of big driving force for writing the book. But I certainly don't have any straightforward answers for it.
You also include an upfront and very personal story at the beginning of the book about your own mental health, even before you introduce us to any of the science or the clinical understanding. Why was this framing in this book with that personal story important for you to add?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I could have written the whole book without mentioning it. But I felt a responsibility to the reader, I suppose, to tell them that this wasn't right up front immediately, that this isn't a purely academic book, and any judgments I make about increasing use of this terminology, for example, is not really coming from a judgmental, detached place, that I know what depression feels like and I know what an anxiety disorder feels like. You know, I debated it about whether to put it in or not, but the reason why I wanted to was, I suppose, I wanted to be honest with the reader that I was sort of immersed in the problem personally as well as academically.
It is, I think, an interesting dichotomy in some of the conversations I've had with people I know in my life who struggle with various mental illnesses, is this idea of people talking about them, but not necessarily understanding. So it was, I think, as a reader, having both pieces in the book allows us to understand that you can see things from a wide variety of different angles. And it really adds to the sort of complexity and nuance of a lot of what you're talking about in the book, which is, as we're going to get into, very complex and very nuanced.
Well, I'm really glad that you say that, because it convinces me that it was worth putting in the book. I think the other relevant fact is that when I had depression and this anxiety disorder, no one really talked about this. It felt incredibly frightening to admit having those problems, because they were so hidden. And, you know, as I recovered and moved further away from it, I noticed all this conversation around me, this explosion of confessions and conversations. And I often wondered, if this had been the conversation when I was unwell, would I have found it useful? And quite often the answer was no. And I wanted to unpack, why was that? Why is it that actually all these efforts to talk about mental health end up being dismissed or met with skepticism? I really wanted to unpack why that was. So again, that was a sort of necessary reason for putting my own experience in.
So possibly the best place to go next, which again is not going to be an easy question, but given we've already talked about how difficult it is to talk about mental health, let's also talk about what mental illness is. I mean, how do we actually define it?
A lot of people would have a lot of different answers to this. My understanding of it is that if your psychology is made up of kind of three pillars, which is your thoughts, your emotions, and the way you behave, that any one or all of those, you know, one, two, or three of those things can start to manifest in unhelpful ways, so that they can become sufficiently extreme or dysfunctional that they stop you living the life that you want and should be able to live, and you find them very distressing. So the point at which those symptoms become symptoms is up for debate. But the way I see mental illness is that it's sort of when your thoughts, emotions, and behavior become dysfunctional to the point where you can't live your life comfortably and it causes you a great deal of distress. I think that, for me, that's my understanding of when you should start saying something's a mental illness.
How does that definition play in the sort of academic world or even the clinical world? Because that's obviously another place that needs a definition of mental illness, a sort of working definition for a wide variety of reasons.
Well, it's interesting, actually. It's not that often that mental illness in itself is defined or needs to be defined. You know, it's like, you know, the debates and arguments are about how exactly do we define what schizophrenia is, and, you know, is schizophrenia a distinct entity that we should label as such, you know, and what is depression, and, you know, is bipolar 2 a distinct disorder from bipolar disorder, for example. So the academic debates are really more about specific disorders, I would say. But I think my broad definition, I think, is fairly uncontroversial. Then the other interesting, provided you buy into the idea that you should sometimes call these things mental illnesses. And then the interesting thing is clinically, it sort of depends what kind of clinician you're talking about. So for a psychiatrist, typically might find it more important to sort of define and diagnose what you have. But, a therapist or a clinical psychologist might not be particularly interested in a diagnosis, but more, what your experience is, what the distress is, and how you can resolve and improve it. That's all I had to say about that.
It's already, we're sort of getting into some of the flex here. Quite quickly in the book, you get into the difficulty of even defining something like depression or something like anxiety. It's always on a spectrum and a scale, and having to define what is, let's call it, a normal unpleasant feeling or a normal unpleasant psychological response or experience to something that has become debilitating. Finding that line, or, as is often the case, where things start to get badly fuzzy has always been a challenge. And it feels like that challenge is maybe getting harder, or maybe we're just reckoning with it differently.
Or reckoning with it more in the public domain. One thing I really wanted to cover in the book is this idea that all mental health symptoms exist on a spectrum. Okay. So there's not like you have people who have an anxiety disorder and people who are completely fine and have no issues with anxiety. There's a sort of gradual spectrum. And as you go up the spectrum, you start feeling anxiety more often, for a longer period of time, more severely. It's more distressing, it's more debilitating for your life, it's more difficult to control. So as you gradually increase on all those various variables, you start to kind of move up the spectrum and towards the end that you might call an illness. This has always been the debate. This isn't, you know, academically, clinically, it's not new, this concept that you have to, you know, put down an artificial line to say where a disorder begins. I think what's shifting now is that this conversation is a little bit more in the public domain, because, you know, we've given the public all these words like, you know, PTSD and social anxiety disorder. And now it's everyone's kind of making up their own mind about what counts as a disorder, you know, within themselves, or when they're judging other people, often people they don't even know.
Yeah, the sort of armchair diagnosis or self-diagnosis is something that I think we're all seeing more of, and probably all participating in, whether we're aware we're doing it or not, in part because the language is and the awareness of it is much more broad, and it feels like it does touch a lot of people. So it just comes up in conversation and in discussion with people and about people more and more.
Definitely, because this is the language that people have been given. You know, this is the sort of norm now that we talk about our emotions and our experiences in this kind of psychiatric language. And I understand why it happens. I mean, this is a completely normal human experience and design. When you experience something, especially something difficult, you want a name for it. And there's a comfort in, you know, realizing that this is, you know, someone else has had this experience, and that it has a name, and that you can, you know, possibly seek help for it. So that's a very comforting experience. So I totally understand why it happens, even when it's, you know, perhaps from the outside, you think, you know, that label, you know, you don't really have PTSD, you're just suffering after a difficult experience. But I understand why people reach for those terms, because they're helpful to an extent in terms of kind of sense making, but they're also that, you know, these are the words that we've given them.
Yeah, people will make sense of things in the best way that they can, like you say, with the tools that they have at their disposal. And these are sort of strangely sort of new tools that we have as a culture that we didn't have before.
Definitely, like the word trauma, for example. I mean, suddenly now many people are framing and understanding their difficult experiences, sometimes horrific experiences, as traumas, whereas maybe, you know, 5, 10, 20 years ago, they just didn't have that name for it or that word for it.
So I want to dig in a little bit to some of the complexities of the world of mental illness and some of the ways in which the awareness of the world that there are people with mental illness, maybe it's more frequent than we realized, and trying to create a conversation to help destigmatize is changing the conversation, maybe sometimes in ways we don't intend, but also in the often hidden complexity that awareness is not shining a light on very well. So I think maybe a good place to start is a little bit about talking about some of the goalposts and the moving of goalposts, because this is something you talk about quite in depth in the book about how things are changing and more is being kind of pulled into the definition of a mental illness or a mental disorder, both kind of in the scientific world and clinical world, but also socially as well.
Yeah. So a really nice example of this is in the DSM, so the kind of diagnostic bible of different mental disorders, and it's gradually grown and grown and grown over the years. And one good example is that depression, previously, if you were presenting with symptoms that appeared to, you know, be depressive symptoms, but you had recently suffered a bereavement, the manual kind of said, don't diagnose depression because it's likely that these symptoms are just grief, just in inverted commas. But then for the most recent edition that came out in 2013, that kind of exclusion criteria was removed, which meant that provided you'd had symptoms of depression for 2 weeks, even if those 2 weeks were following the death of your partner, for example, you could technically officially be considered to have depression. And I think that's a lot of pushback against the DSM and against the whole sort of cultural climate around psychiatric diagnoses have been things to do with that people have been too readily labeling very difficult, you know, psychological experiences, but understandable ones as disorders. I mean, there's another layer of complexity there, which is that I don't think just because something is an understandable response that we therefore can't use the word illness or disorder. You know, a lot of PTSD, it's totally understandable that people would react in such an extreme way to awful things. So I don't buy the idea that, oh, if there's an understandable trigger, we can't use the word disorder. But because, you know, the outcome can still very much act like a disorder. But yeah, I think that's where a lot of this backlash is coming from, this idea that we're too quickly calling horrible but normal emotions disorders, and that has all sorts of problems as consequences.
So what are some of the consequences of labeling those things disorders that maybe we weren't labeling things as disorders before? What are some of those consequences potentially?
So, two obvious ones for me. One is that they're quite heavy labels to take on. So we talked a minute ago about how labels can help with kind of sense making, and it's comforting, but it's also can be scary. You know, if you experience something difficult and you then believe your response is PTSD, you're then taking on this kind of weight of potentially having a disorder or worrying that there's something wrong with your brain or your mind, or that there's more permanence, you know, that it will be harder to come out of it if what you have is a disorder. So one potential consequence is these for the individuals for whom perhaps, you know, a disorder actually isn't a useful label. So the kind of people at the milder end of the spectrum. So there's one cost. And the cost that follows on from that is that people become skeptical of the whole concept of mental illness and mental health problems, because, you know, if suddenly everyone is saying they have one, you know, people think, oh, you can't all be unwell, so none of you are, kind of thing. And then you know, no one ends up being believed. So that's one problem. And the other problem, I think, is that people who really do need this language, so people who really are seriously, severely unwell, those terms have lost some currency for them. So if we kind of label every you know, period of low mood in the pandemic and lockdown, if we call all of that depression, then what language is left for the people who really very blatantly and obviously have debilitating depression? You know, those terms lose value. So I think there's kind of costs at both ends of the spectrum, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely one of these difficult conversations. I think about the idea of depression and grief and how those things may intertwine and kind of either feed into each other when they're both there, but also how easy it is to make assumptions about grief, whereas grief is just a thing that takes time and passes and is deeply unpleasant and is deeply painful. Mm-hmm. But it is also sort of unescapably painful in a sort of different way than depression can be. So, but at the same time, you don't want to, I think you talk about this in the book a little bit, you don't want to put a gate in front of the ability to get help when maybe you do get help for something like, oh, well, you're just grieving, right?
Exactly. Because it's perfectly plausible that you could be grieving, you could have lost someone, and then you do develop depression. You know, disorders like depression are often triggered by stressful events. So it's just because you've suffered a bereavement doesn't mean you can't then develop depression. So if you look at that DSM change in a more sympathetic way, you could say, well, actually, they were trying to make sure that you weren't, yeah, unfairly putting the gate up for people who could need help. But yes, the cost and the issue is that if you're not careful, you end up sort of assuming all grief is depression and something that can be medicalized and medicated away when it can't and it shouldn't.
Definitely a challenge in talking about these topics for sure. And trying to figure out what the right treatment is or help, and whether that is a clinical help or a community help. And, you know, when someone is grieving, they quite often do need help, but they don't necessarily need clinical help. They need help of their community and their peers and their family. I think partly as well, sometimes we're deeply uncomfortable with people who are experiencing negative emotions. Mm-hmm. And now that we're more comfortable talking about medical approaches or specialists who can help, I think we've all forgotten that sometimes we are capable of helping as well.
I think it's such a good point. And I think about it in schools as well. So a lot of, and this is only anecdotal, but, you know, teachers and educational psychologists have said to me that there's a sort of fear now among teachers that, oh, this is a mental health problem, therefore we need to sort of refer it on. Whereas, you know, they've sort of lost a sense of power that they have themselves to actually support a lot of particularly milder mental health problems. And again, same with the grief thing, the cost of calling grief depression could be that you then don't rely on the sort of social side of things, which is hugely powerful. I think someone said it to me in an interesting way recently, not to do with grief, but just in general, the way we're tackling mental health problems at the moment is that we're saying either there's individual solutions that, you know, you need to go and learn mindfulness or you need to do exercise, or there's kind of medical external professional solutions. And what we're forgetting is the third piece of the puzzle, which is social support, which is, you know, we know makes so much difference to people's mental health. And it's almost like if we medicalize too much, then we forget the role of, caring and looking after each other and social support.
It is a thing that I think about a lot in the working world, but also in my personal life. I remember through my life those people, family, friends, coworkers who have mentored me through difficult times, who have provided me support in those difficult times. And I look to where I can provide support for people, but I do find myself in the last few years sometimes questioning whether or not I'm overstepping. Is this my support to offer? Is it something, should I be referring them? Should I be, is this too big for me? Am I going to lead them astray? There's this sort of concern, I think, that comes from when is my help or my support giving, when am I supporting someone with their anxiety or their depression or their grief or whatever those feelings are versus when am I not enough for that, I guess, is the awkwardly phrased.
Yeah, I completely understand the dilemma. And I think, well, first, I think they're not mutually exclusive. You know, I think you can offer social support alongside encouraging someone to explore the option of external support. But you nicely raised the issue with, well, the issue that I have with a lot of these mental health awareness campaigns, which is that they're encouraging people to talk about their mental health problems, but they're not necessarily giving much thought to the listener and how incredibly difficult it is. It really is difficult to support someone, particularly long term, who's going through a mental illness or just a difficult, very difficult period in life. It's hard to know your role. It's hard to know what you should say. It's hard to know how often you should check in, how worried you should be if they don't pick up their phone, etc. And this can go on for months and months. It is really difficult. People are trying to navigate it all the time, trying to figure out how to be a good friend and how to be supportive. It's really hard.
Definitely. There is a sort of general sense that rates of mental illness are on the rise. Certainly, definitely more people are talking about mental illness than ever before. So there's definitely more awareness. Are the rates actually going up? Or is this one of these dichotomies where because we're talking about it a lot and it's becoming more okay to talk about it a lot that we are seeing a lot more conversations, so it feels like things are rising?
It's really, really hard to know the answer for the exact reason that you've given. It's very difficult to pick those things apart. So, and then also the pandemic has complicated things. So this was a question I was very interested in pre-pandemic. And then the conversation has shifted to talking about how the pandemic has increased rates of mental health problems. But broadly, yes, if you ask groups of people via questionnaire or via interviews if they have symptoms, and you look at the prevalence of people reporting symptoms, you know, 10 years ago and more recently, generally, the evidence shows that people more often now report symptoms of mental health problems. So anxiety, depression, self-harm, suicide has also increased. But we'll set suicide aside for a moment because it's a slightly separate question. But if you're just talking about distress, about anxiety and depression and self-harm, it's very difficult to unpack whether things really are increasing or whether people are just more willing to admit it now. So because stigma has decreased, people are more willing, definitely more willing to go to the GP and more willing to go on antidepressants, for example. But it could also trickle down to a questionnaire. You know, you have more awareness of your own mental health and your distress. So a question like, I experienced low mood in the last week, people might now be much more willing to admit it than they did in the past. So that's a good thing, but it also blurs our understanding of how much things have really changed. And then there's a third more complicated phenomenon, which is that people's understanding of the question might have changed. So the way people read that question, you know, I've had low mood in the last week. What they understand low mood even is could be different now. And it could be leaning more towards people interpreting milder symptoms as being a problematic low mood than they would in the past. So I think all three of those things are going on at the same time, and we can't we won't know for sure exactly what it is, but I suspect the increased rates that we're seeing are a combination of people really are more distressed for whatever reason. People are more willing to talk about it. And also people's, the boundary at which people consider something a problem has shifted. The slightly separate phenomenon is suicide, and that has increased in the US and in the UK. And that evidence suggests that it might be more about distress increasing. But at the same time, there's also interesting nuance there, like the threshold for which something is recorded as a suicide rather than an accidental death has changed. Meaning that more deaths are likely to be recorded as a suicide. So I'm not saying that's the explanation for the rises, but rather that there's always lots of different components going on. But I think, so suicide is a slightly separate issue, but I think when it comes to distress, so anxiety and depression, people are certainly reporting more of them, but it's difficult to figure out why exactly that is.
Right. Is it more people are feeling these things, or more people are willing to admit to feeling these things? Or we're counting more things in a way that socially we understand as these things. So there's a complex feedback mechanism here that sounds like it makes trying to pick apart the answer to the question of are we seeing more cases of mental disorders than we used to? A very difficult question to answer.
It's really difficult. I don't think there is an answer. I think we need to, take seriously the possibility that people really are more unhappy than they used to be, particularly during the pandemic or in the aftermath of the pandemic. But I'm just keen to be cautious about all this I'm keen to be cautious about all the negative press about mental health, because I think actually if you too willingly pump out the message that everyone's in crisis and everything's terrible and everything's worse than it used to be, that can affect the way people interpret their mood and their experiences. So you can end up contributing to the crisis by telling everyone that there is a crisis. So I'm very keen to promote the message that this isn't straightforward. And even if things have increased, it doesn't mean that everyone's unhappy, because that's another thing that gets a bit lost, especially with teenagers. You know, the assumption ends up being that, all teenagers are in crisis. And that's not a helpful message to give them, to give the teenagers.
Yeah, that's a very complicated, all of us who are no longer teenagers were at one point teenagers, and I think we all have some memory of our own experiences of that time. And everyone that I've ever talked to about being a teenager has variations of a very similar conversation. It's a tough time. There's a lot going on, and a lot is changing about your brain and your body and your environment and your life, and it's a lot to deal with. there's a lot of world around you suddenly.
There is. And so imagine growing up and having all of that going on, and then being kind of pummeled with the message that if you're a teenager, you have mental health problems. Obviously, that's going to color the way you interpret your, transient low mood or, exam anxiety or whatever. We're giving them this message that this is how to interpret your experiences. And yes, it's a good thing if it means you catch the people who really are struggling, or you catch the people before things escalate into really struggling. But the downside and the cost is that you've told everyone that it's a sort of likely possibility that they've got a mental health problem or a mental disorder. And that's, we need to think very carefully about the consequences of that, of this, well-intended awareness raising.
So what do we know about adolescents in particular? Because as you sort of go through some of the data that you break down very carefully in the book around trying to tease apart the answer that we may not have to whether or not mental illness rates are rising or not, you do dive a little bit into some breakouts of some specific groups. And it does seem that adolescents and that kind of that age group often gets a light shone on it as a particularly tumultuous time and a definitely a likely time if you are vulnerable to mental illness that you something might get triggered. So can you talk a little bit about that time of life and why mental disorders so often kind of pop up and why we have kind of created this focus on that time of life?
Definitely. So as you will know, I have a chapter of the book about adolescence. That was always my background and what I work on in my research. So we now know that if you're ever going to develop a mental illness, a mental disorder, it will have happened most likely by your early 20s. So if you get to kind of 24, 25 and you haven't developed a mental illness, your chances of ever getting one, it's obviously still happened, but it drops off after that. So the adolescent years, so kind of between what I would say between 10 and 24, or sometimes 10 and 20, are definitely a period of risk for developing mental health problem or a mental disorder. And the way I often explain it and think about it is because it's a massive period of change. So it's a period of biological change. So there's rapid development across the brain, but also the body, because of puberty, you know, you change what you look like, your body changes. But then also there's huge changes in the outside world. So there's the shift to secondary school or high school. You're suddenly spending much more unsupervised time with, you know, the very peers that you're most biologically interested in, biologically driven to be interested in. And, you know, change can create chaos. And one researcher, Jay Geed, described it as moving parts get broken. So while you're in this state of flux in your brain and in the outside world, some people can become vulnerable. It's when things start happening in the outside world for a lot of people, and it happens at the same time as this massive internal biological change.
Can you talk a little bit as well about sort of what we know between the kind of genetic biological impacts, not impacts, causes or sources of, not even sure the right terminology for mental disorders, versus some of the environmental and kind of experiential triggers? Because I definitely know that both are big contributors and they sort of lean into each other to some extent.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because sometimes there's a bit of a battleground about, you know, are mental illnesses biological disorders? Are they sort of, you know, internally triggered biologically? You know, can we find the answer by looking in the brain or by looking at people's genetics? Or actually, is the answer really in the outside social world? And really, it's that, you know, if difficult things happen to you or enough difficult things happen to you, you can develop a mental disorder as a result. But I'm very much an advocate that it's a bit of both. We haven't managed to unpack the specific detail, but we do know that if you get a group of people with depression, for example, and compare them to a group of people who don't, there are differences in their brain when they're processing different tasks, for example. But we absolutely have not found like a straightforward signature in the brain or genetically. There are no biomarkers for these disorders. You can't take a blood test and be told that you have OCD, for example. And because you can't, that's led a lot of people to think, you know, maybe the answer doesn't really lie in the brain. But I think it partly lies in the brain and in the biology, in a person's biology. And I believe that because not all people who experience stress in the outside world develop a disorder. So that must mean that there's something within the individual that's relevant as well. At the same time, some people develop these disorders without any obvious traumas in the outside world. So the way I came to understand it is that there is an individual internal vulnerability, biological cognitive vulnerability, that can then be exacerbated, triggered, set off by something, by some stress that happens in the outside world. And that stress can might be something relatively minor, or it might be something major, depends on the individual. But the way I understand it is that it's both, and we need to understand it at both levels if we're looking at what causes mental illness?
I definitely, in the book, you sort of talk about the genetic biological side as perhaps creating a vulnerability where the environment and experience is more of a trigger that people who are more vulnerable or more susceptible to, and both sort of need to be there in some amount for things to go awry.
Exactly. I think that's the most useful way of looking at it and understanding it. You might have some underlying vulnerability or susceptibility, as you say. It's not a predetermined destiny, but it means that you will be more at risk of developing something when you're exposed to certain stressful situations.
Of course, this idea of a genetic predisposition or a biological predisposition to certain mental disorders is complicated through the idea of parenting, because parenting provide both a deep genetic connection, but also, as we know, a deep environment and experiential connection, because our lives when we are young are so grounded by and curated by and modeled by the people who raise us, our parents.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why if you want to understand the sort of genetic risk involved, you can't just look at people who are raised by their biological parents. Because if you find, it's absolutely true that depression and various mental disorders run in families, as in if you have parents with the disorder, you're more likely to have them. But that's from looking at people raised by their biological parents alone. You can't know whether that's a sort of true genetic thing or whether it's the fact that they're being raised by the person with the disorder. So if your parent has depression, for example, they will find it more difficult to parent you sometimes, or it might affect the way that they parent you in a way that itself sets up risk that's separate from the genetics. So the way that researchers figure out whether there is a genetic component to this disorder is they look at adopted studies and twin studies. And so what they show is that even when you remove a child from the biological parent who has depression, that child remains at elevated risk even when they're being brought up by different people. So that's a really useful clue that it's that there's some genetic component. And then the other one is that they look at twin studies. So and for kind of across the board with psychiatric disorders, if you're a twin and your twin has the disorder, you are more at risk of developing it yourself if you're identical twins than if you're non-identical. So both those pieces of evidence, so the twin studies and the adoption studies, tell us that kind of across the board with disorders, there is a genetic component. What people haven't been able to figure out is, identifying a depression gene or even, a series of genes that are clearly associated with depression. That's proved to be much more difficult.
Yeah, there's definitely, as you say, and I think you said earlier, there's no biomarkers for mental disorders. We don't have kind of a predictive capacity to be able to predict just through looking at a brain scan or a blood test who is likely to have a mental disorder or not.
Exactly. And so people often use that as a reason to say that biology isn't involved. But I don't buy that more extreme argument, because the brain must be involved somehow, because every thought and feeling and behavior that you engage in is channeled through the workings of your brain. So the brain must be involved. We just don't know whether it's the ultimate cause or what exactly the involvement is.
I think as well the fact that we see people with different with similar life experiences, some of whom suffer very badly with mental disorders and others who have a resilience or a way of responding, or just for whatever reason, don't, to those similar kinds of life experiences, means that it can't all just be a trigger. If it was a trigger, then it would impact everyone the same. So there's sort of something else in the mix there.
Exactly. I think that's what's so important. Like if you, track people who've been even a victim of very extreme trauma, like a terrorist attack, they don't all develop a mental disorder as a result. So that tells you something really important. That tells you that there's something within the individual that predicts what will happen in the aftermath of stress or trauma. yeah, I think that's kind of perfect evidence that it must be a bit of both.
I guess some of that as well is genetic, but also potentially learned behavior. I often wonder if it's something, how much of it is, you know, I think back to when I was a kid and doing, you know, the anxiety of presenting in front of a classroom of people. That is a, you know, that you worry about that. That's nerve-wracking, especially if you've never done it before. And as I personally have gone through life, that's something that I am more used to doing. I don't get much anxiety before doing something like that. It has become comfortable, as have many other things in life that used to cause me some amount of anxiety or concern or worry or longer periods of low mood. I feel like many people also learn how to manage those things and learn coping mechanisms that help us get through those periods, which feels like a very human thing to do.
Yeah, and it's really important when it comes to anxiety and what we were talking about in terms of, you know, too willingly medicalizing things. With anxiety, for example, during public speaking or talking to your class, avoidance is kind of the worst thing you can do, because you, exactly what you said, you, in order to learn how to cope, you have to do these things that scare you and frighten you, because by repeatedly doing them, you realize then maybe not as bad as you thought they would be. And importantly, that if you do find them difficult, that you cope. So one thing that bothers me about the conversation with anxiety is that we're too readily using it as a reason to not do something, when actually, even though it's hard and it's horrible, and I know this so personally, that the best thing you can do is to try and do the thing that scares you. You might need to get a lot of help to do it, but that you do need to try and do it. Otherwise, the anxiety persists. And yeah, your description is exactly right.
There's an amount of my brain can cope, but also that I learn to cope.
Yes, exactly. And you need to have a little bit of belief that you will cope in order to do it. So, you know, maybe that means that you need a lot of external support possibly to help you get to that point, or, you know, you break it down into tiny pieces and you do the small step that you think you can do and you build it from there. But the solution is never to avoid entirely.
This is interesting, because it's reminding me of a conversation I had with a person in my life who had a period of depression that she sought help for. And one of the things afterwards, years afterwards, that she spoke about was that what helps her now when she's struggling with those periods is the memory that it got better before, so it will again. Sort of this, not hope, but just telling herself, it got better before when I really thought it wouldn't, so I'm just going to assume that this too will get better. And she finds that hope now, that experience, that past experience of having done it, and she got help and there was medication available to her when she needed it. But she definitely finds that what she uses now more than anything else is the proof that it improved before.
It's so interesting. And I really personally identify with that. And I rely on that a lot myself, because when you do feel bad, it's part of the mind state. Is that, you know, the definition of the problem is that you believe you're going to be like that forever. So it's very important to try and find some, you know, small corner of your mind that can tell you that you felt like this before and it didn't last forever and you came out of it. It's partly why the first time is so scary, because you don't have that personal evidence base.
Yeah, that thing to lean on and to sort of hang on to while you're floating through it.
Yeah, exactly. But if you do come out of it and go back in again, at least then you've got experience that it was temporary before. So yeah, I relate a lot to your friend's experience.
I also want to talk a little bit about social media, because this is another thing you talk about quite a lot in the book. I believe there's a chapter dedicated to it. Why did you want to talk about social media in particular in this book?
Because I think if you talk about mental health, the current mental health situation or crisis, or if you think about mental health and adolescence, sooner or later, someone's going to bring up social media. It's so often kind of the bogeyman that's kind of blamed for this apparent increase in mental health problems in young people. So I was really keen to unpack what the evidence actually was. I felt like there was so much more to it than was often being spouted in newspapers and in conversation. So I really wanted to kind of lay out what do we know about social media? And is it maybe not quite as bad as we think it might be?
Your term bogeyman made me smile because I do think that it has become social media, even setting aside just for a second this specific conversation around mental illness and mental disorders, it does feel like social media is increasingly the sort of bogeyman that we're pointing to, be like, oh, it's social media's fault.
Yeah, definitely. And I wonder when that will stop. At what point will it become so embedded within our social world that it's not seen as a separate entity anymore, and it stops being so interesting and stops being treated as this new phenomenon rather than actually a kind of mirror of what was going on already.
So as you unpacked this idea of, is social media the reason for this? Does social media deserve the blame we're giving it right now? What overall did you find in that exploration?
My sort of overall conclusion about social media, based on the evidence, is that on average, it's not doing much harm. On average, if you measure how many hours people spend on social media, and then you look at their subsequent levels of depression or anxiety, for example, there's either no relationship or it's so tiny that it's not meaningful or nothing to be worried about. A lot of people have kind of concluded that that's sort of job done, social media isn't harmful. But I think still within that, just because on average there's not much of a relationship, there are still some young people and some adults who are reasonably being harmed by what they're doing online for all sorts of reasons, in terms of posting selfies that then don't get the feedback that they want or the feedback compared to their peers, or searching for images of self-harm or kind of tips about eating disorders, for example. Cyberbullying is also relevant and real phenomenon. So I think I've landed on the idea that these platforms can cause some harm to some individuals. But even then, I caveat that by thinking you don't know what those individuals were like, in a parallel universe where social media doesn't exist. There's really no way of addressing scientifically whether the social media has caused the problem, or whether, they were going to be unhappy anyway. So I think if there is someone that social media is obviously causing them difficulty, I think you need to zoom out a little bit and think about what else is going on and in what ways are they already vulnerable, rather than just kind of blaming the phone.
Sort of the question of, if someone's posting selfies that aren't getting likes sort of repeatedly and getting into that loop, are we focusing too much on the mechanism of that loop, or not quite enough on the fact that this person probably, or maybe, I guess probably is probably the wrong word, this person might find another way to fulfill that negative loop without social media, because there's all kinds of different ways to badly loop.
And it's not like the concept of adolescent girls being unhappy with their appearance is new, that, and boys to an extent, that has always been, adolescence has always been this time of acute self-consciousness and body changes. So I don't think social media has given us a new problem there. But what it has done is it's given us given young people a new avenue in which to feel self-conscious and unhappy about their bodies. So if you are that kind of adolescent and you're already vulnerable, then yes, social media might be a difficult experience for you.
You also talk about some of the positive things that social media has provided, things like support and community. There are people who are finding help and finding support for the negative experiences they're having, whether it be mental disorders or just the feeling, you know, the sort of quote unquote normal negative feelings that we experience as being people. A lot of people are finding support for that and community to help them through that and help them cope online. So there's also pros there. There's positive impacts of social media, which are so easy to overlook when you are mostly just looking for the negative impacts.
Exactly, which is so important. You know, I think it can be bad for mental health sometimes, but I think it can also be good for mental health, all the things you've just described. I mean, if you've got a mental illness or a mental health problem, in terms of support groups, you know, a lot of content about self-harm or eating disorders online now is about recovery. So a lot of people find their kind of support group online. But even moving away from the problem end of things, social media can be an incredibly powerful tool for connecting with people that you love and for having fun. It seems to have been completely lost from the conversation that part of the reason why young people and adults go on these apps is because they're fun, not always, obviously, but sometimes. And yeah, the pandemic and the lockdowns really spelt that out, I think, how much people rely on them for entertainment. So I think, yeah, you can't have a conversation about adolescent mental health and social media and just focus on the bad stuff. You know, these apps are good for mental health sometimes for some people as well.
Absolutely. And especially during a time of pandemic when we were forced to be physically distant from each other, it allowed us to feel, in many cases, emotionally present as best we could while we had to be socially distanced.
Exactly. I mean, I think we all, yeah, I like, God knows what I would have done without my phone, you know, if it was a pre-social media, pre-internet era when the pandemic happened. I just think it was beneficial in so many ways for a lot of people. There was one study that showed that younger children's mental health was more badly affected than adolescents' mental health in the pandemic. And one sort of suggested explanation that the authors had was that maybe adolescents were able to stay connected with their friends and that acted as a buffer towards developing mental health problems in a way that younger people, the kind of pre-social media children, weren't able to. And I thought that was very interesting.
That's interesting. So the idea that because once you get to a certain age, you're kind of in control of your social media life in a way that you probably have a device and have access to a way to connect with those people, where probably below a certain age, that's just not an open option for you. You need someone to facilitate that experience.
Exactly. And you need a parent to facilitate it, and you need to be physically taken to a place where you can physically play with another child. So, you know, that is your social world when you're a child. But in adolescence, maybe it shifts more to the kind of, you know, intimacy and self-disclosure and talking and sharing and, yeah, having fun. And that all of that can happen to an extent via a phone, and that maybe that kind of buoyed some of them to a degree.
Interesting. That's one of the first times I've heard a little bit of that. So I'm definitely going to go in and read a little bit more about some.
Yeah, I can share the paper with you if you're interested.
That would be great if you wouldn't mind. And we can add that link for our listeners as well.
Yes, good idea.
I'm curious to get your thoughts on, as we're seeing mental illness discussions happening more and more, we are also seeing people bringing who identify as having a mental disorder or mental illness of some kind. Mm-hmm. People are definitely seem to be more willing to say, I have OCD, mm-hmm. or I have social anxiety, or I have bipolar disorder. There are people who are claiming those as part of their identities, mm-hmm. and claiming them vocally and being quite happy to talk about them. You see it a lot more often in social media profiles, that someone's sort of right off the bat, this is a thing about me and I'm not hiding it. It's here. This is maybe something I talk about a lot. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on us kind of, and us sort of collectively starting to bring these ideas of mental disorder into our own identity and kind of claiming those terms or claiming those identities, and whether or not that's a positive move or a negative mood or move, or probably a mixture of both, I guess.
I was going to say, as my usual answer is that I think it's a bit of both. I think the phenomenon you described is so interesting, and I've certainly noticed it myself. I think, yeah, the social media bio thing is a really interesting little piece of evidence, isn't it? Because it's a very explicit demonstration that this is who I am. This is an important part of me that I want to publicly share and let you know about. There's plenty of reasons why that's a good thing. I mean, I think that's better than the time when people were so ashamed that they had to try and have these symptoms totally in secret. You know, a lot of mental disorders are very long term. So if kind of owning it and identifying it and talking about it is useful, then that's a good thing, of course. But the potential cost comes, I think, particularly among young people, if they take on these labels too readily, and possibly to a point where they are not motivated to try and tackle them when maybe they could. You know, like anxiety, for example, you know, there are evidence-based treatments that work for some people. So is there a cost in taking on an identity in terms of your willingness to seek treatment? I don't know, but that's a potential concern. One interesting manifestation of the phenomenon is in a yoga class a couple of years ago, I saw the girl next to me had a tattoo on her arm that said, "Warrior, warrior." And I thought that was very interesting. Like you so identify with being someone that has a problem with worry that you've tattooed it on your body. And yeah, what does that mean? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know.
Or potentially just a neutral thing. It really depends on all the particulars of that person and how they feel looking at that phrase, right? Maybe it's an empowering thing for them to know that they're trying to seize control of that.
Exactly.
But it could also be self-reinforcing. So yeah.
Exactly. So I think it's both, and it probably depends on the person, and you might get both within the same person across time. I don't know.
So for people listening and trying to reckon with the complicated world in front of us, either who feel like they maybe are struggling right now with something, maybe they have a diagnosis, fresh or a long time diagnosis, or even just know someone in their life, or who are trying to figure out how to navigate this world. Do you have any advice or places to start? Like what is a thing or some things that we can do to approach a world that has more awareness of mental illness and mental disorders as things that exist, but not necessarily in a lot of the nuance?
They could read my book. because that's what I attempted to do with that book, to try and lay out that complexity. There are other good books. I'm thinking in particular, Nathan Filer, who I quoted at the beginning, has written an excellent book about schizophrenia and he puts schizophrenia in inverted commas throughout, because he's, you know, being cautious about the idea that that's a definitive entity that we should keep using. So that book's excellent. I think to have an awareness that these disorders and these terms are not definitive fixed realities that you have to take on board to describe your own experience if you don't want to. You know, like if you would rather frame your experience as grief rather than depression in the aftermath of an bereavement, then, you know, there is lots of flexibility here. It's not like if you read that it might be depression or a doctor tells you that it might be depression, it doesn't mean that's a definitive truth. So I think, reading widely and just being reassured in a way about the looseness of some of this terminology. Like, for example, I spoke to someone recently and they said that their partner had sort of discovered that he had social anxiety disorder or read up on it and was very bothered about the idea that he had this condition. And I was thinking, you know, well, depending on the level of severity, but even if it is very severe, you know, you have some flexibility about whether you frame that as a disorder or not. So that's really important. There's the benefits of this murkiness means that, yeah, people have some freedom about how they describe their experiences.
Do you think self-diagnosis is a good thing?
No, because I think I don't know where it ends if you say that self-diagnosis is kind of as good as being diagnosed by a clinical professional. You know, you wouldn't diagnose a lot of physical disorders on your own. You might think you might have something and then you'd go and talk to someone who knows more about it. I certainly don't think self-diagnosis should replace clinical diagnosis. But I can see why people do it, because it's this comforting thing about understanding themselves. So I see why it happens, but I think, I'm cautious about the costs of it, I guess.
It's something that I have been thinking a lot about lately, not necessarily for the extreme cases, but I think about having read up on certain aspects of different types of mental disorders. Great example for me is ADHD. There's a lot that I read about from people who write things about their experiences with ADHD that I really identify with. Mm-hmm. And some interesting things there that I go, okay, that feels like me, that sort of those little bits of it. And I guess maybe I'm not always thinking about self-diagnosing in a, I don't think I have ADHD, but if you were to put someone on a spectrum, you know, if you were to sort of put me on a spectrum of, isn't it all like ADHD and is entirely like ADHD, I get a sense that I'm maybe a little closer to one side than the other, and not in a problematic way, but it's helped me kind of be like, oh, okay, there's some other people and here's some interesting strategies they use for things that also trip me up all the time. So it's maybe that's not self-diagnosing, though I think sometimes we talk about it in that way. But sometimes those things are, I find a lot of utility in those kinds of things because they open up ways of coping or ways of managing that can be really helpful.
Definitely, which I think is a good thing about, you know, this increased awareness and conversation. And I think actually you've captured there a really nice way of thinking about this, which is that to promote the idea of a spectrum and to recognize that you might be a little bit higher up the spectrum than some other people, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're at the extreme end of it. So yes, ADHD is a good example in that lots of people can identify with, you know, various difficulties with concentration, for example, and attention. To use the knowledge that we have gained from people with ADHD, but to recognize that you can have a bit of something because it's all on a spectrum without necessarily having to take on the label itself. And that, I mean, anxiety is so important to that. Mm-hmm. I think it would be useful if more people saw themselves as just kind of being prone to feeling anxious with, you know, prone to feeling anxious in social situations, you know, knowingly more so than other people are, but that doesn't mean they're up at the extreme end of having a disorder.
Yeah, it's I wish there was another term for what I'm talking about, but it tends to just kind of fall in the bucket of self-diagnosis when I have conversations with people. You know, like, I don't want to armchair diagnose you or anything, but yeah, you sound a little bit like X. But it can be useful to spawn conversations in a way that I think in the moment sometimes can be really helpful with the right conversation and the right person. I know I've definitely had some conversations with people where we've been able to trigger into much more deep, honest conversations by probing that a little bit. So it, Yeah, I struggle sometimes with this idea of self-diagnosis. I definitely think you can take it way, way, way too far, and some people definitely do, but I've also found some utility in it to open up conversations and to open up ideas and make space for ideas with certain people in my life and with myself that I'm not sure I could have done otherwise.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's one of the benefits of talking about all of this more, is that it does give us the language of some concepts that are really useful. And I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with that at all. And that, to sort of use them slightly cautiously and be aware of this idea of it being a spectrum. And also the other thing is that if you consider yourself to be kind of further up on whatever spectrum, or you're talking to your friend and that's a useful way of thinking about it, to then think at that point, it might be useful to go and seek additional advice about a potential diagnosis. So, you know, for example, if you find that you need to eat really regularly and you feel faint if you don't eat frequently enough, then maybe it's useful to go and, you know, you've explored the idea of diabetes online, and then at that point maybe it's useful to go and speak to someone else.
Yeah, I think maybe part of what we're struggling with is we've got so much information at our fingertips that we didn't used to have before, which is searchable and findable in a different way. And when do we transition that from our sort of own private research, understanding, reckoning with, to I actually need to talk to a real expert about this thing because it's now transitioned from, like, where is that, you know, we talk about cutoff and fuzzy line again. Where is that fuzzy line where maybe I've transitioned to, I do need to book an appointment with somebody. I do need to talk to an expert about this rather than just my friend Jane.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, you know, if you're worried about it, and if you're worried about it for, you know, not just a fleeting moment, there's, I think the point at which you would go and talk to someone again, it's a fuzzy line. But if you're worried about it, then yeah, go and seek additional advice and information. And if you don't find one person particularly helpful, then go and speak to another person. You know, you'll get different perspectives on your problem. None of this is to say that, oh, you need to just keep this to yourself because you don't meet the full criteria. You know, if you're concerned about something you're experiencing, or, you know, it's changed or it's upsetting you, or it means you can't do the things that you want to do, then yeah, absolutely go and get a professional opinion on it.
Lucy, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you taking the time, and it's a really interesting book. I enjoyed reading it, and I highly recommend to all our listeners to go pick it up and take a look.
Thank you so much.
And if you want to learn more about Lucy, her research, or her book, Losing Our Minds, What Mental Illness Really Is and Isn't, as always, you will find links to get you started in the show notes for this episode, which you should see in the podcast app you're using to listen to us now, and which are always available on our website, scienceforthepeople.ca. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Science for the People. Science for the People is listener supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.